Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Toby Wilkinson, the acclaimed Egyptologist and head of the International Strategy Office at the University of Cambridge. Although he has authored many works about aspects of Egyptian history and culture, a layman might know him best from his award-winning book, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Egypt, or perhaps the BBC documentary, Building the Great Pyramid, which is great. Today, however, we'll be talking about his latest work, The World Beneath the Sands, The Golden Age of Egyptology, published October 20th by W.W. Norton & Company. So rather than focusing on the history of an empire, today we'll be talking about those whose work allows us in great part to be able to understand that history in the first place. So it will truncate the scope of this interview from three millennia of history and near a couple of centuries of incredibly hard work, exploration, intrigue, and unfortunately plunder. Those who unearthed literally and figuratively histories of this ancient world and perhaps mysteries yet to be discovered. So if obsession is not too strong a word for those who are driven to uncover Egypt's secrets, today we may well be talking to one of those who may also be just as obsessed. So good afternoon, Toby, and thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how did you first become enamored, because I've read this, when you were 5 years old, with the whole idea of this Egyptology?
Yeah, it goes back a long way, as you've said. When I was five, my parents bought me for my fifth birthday present a children's encyclopedia. This was in the days before the internet when people read books. And I have a child's encyclopedia. And one of the entries in that book was around different writing systems from around the world and from across history. So there was Roman script and there was Arabic script. And my five-year-old eyes kind of lit upon the hieroglyphics and thought, hey, that's really neat, writing in little pictures. And because my name is very short, it's only four letters long, I was able to work out how to write Toby in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics on my fifth birthday. And I thought, I'd love to be able to do this properly someday. And it started from there.
Well, so looking at your bibliography and your Wikipedia entry, is it wrong to say you're obsessed?
Well, Egypt has been a running theme in my life for several decades now. And you know, there's always more to discover. There's always more to learn. That's the great thing about Egyptology is, although, as I explain in my book, antiquarians and archaeologists and explorers have been studying ancient Egypt for sort of scientifically now for 200 years or more, there's still so much more to find out. And almost every month, there's a new discovery or a new interpretation. So it's a very dynamic field, and it's always full of interest. And of course, it's so exotic and magical, and we gaze in awe at the pyramids and we marvel at the treasures of Tutankhamun. And who could fail to be attracted by it, really?
Yeah, it's funny, when I said at the beginning, I wasn't sure if I was right. Mysteries yet to be found. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's like saying everything under the sun has been discovered. Then I realized, no, not at all.
Not at all. I mean, even in somewhere as well excavated as the Valley of the Kings, there is still potentially one more royal tomb left undiscovered. I mean, the great thing about that is, you know, when Carter and Carnarvon were excavating and they discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, they were systematically clearing the bottom of the valley from all the kind of debris of centuries, all the way down to the bedrock. Well, of course, they found Tutankhamun's tomb. That work stopped, and it's never really continued right down to the bottom of the valley. So there is still just the possibility that somewhere in that bottom part of the valley, that has not yet been cleared, there is entrance to an undiscovered tomb. Now, wouldn't that be amazing?
Well, yeah, that's the way you can tell if you're obsessed. That would be like Christmas morning for you, wouldn't it?
It certainly would.
Well, if we're going to actually go, and I haven't read the history, and now I will, because I just didn't know about you, to be honest. And then when I watched the documentary, well, actually, let me explain it this way. There are four things in my life that I can't believe. First of all, the Statue of David. when I look at it and see him looking at Goliath, and you know by looking into his eyes that there's no way that Goliath is going to beat him. He's alive, and that's not possible. He's not alive. And then when I look at the Cathedral Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, same thing. I'm going, this is 200 years, and it's still not finished, and it's an impossible thing. Or if I look at the Duomo in Florence, and I say, how can that support itself? And then when I went to Egypt and looked at the pyramids, the first thing I thought was, this is impossible. It's just not, it can't happen. And I wasn't, the other things like David and the Duomo and the cathedral, they are the way they look. Whereas I'm not seeing the pyramids the way that they originally looked when the outer sheathing was on.
Absolutely right. And, you know, a large part of that is down to the archaeologists who investigated the pyramids in the 19th century. And one of them, who I talk about in my book, Howard Vyse, he wasn't really an archaeologist. He was an army guy, and he was an amateur archaeologist. And he decided to investigate the pyramids by blowing them apart with dynamite. And by drilling into the back of the Sphinx to see if there was a hidden chamber, which there wasn't. But he literally set gunpowder charges to try and blast his way into the pyramids. And the result was what you see today, which are still amazing monuments, but not quite their former selves.
Yeah, and when I was researching for this, I did read about him. And the one positive about it was they were able to see the different types of stones that were inside. Mm-hmm. Even though he did a horrible, dastardly thing, there was an educational process to it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we learned a lot from those early explorers. We wouldn't now replicate their methodologies, but we certainly learned a lot. And I guess what I'm trying to chart in the book is not only how we learn more and more about ancient Egypt over the course of the 19th and early 20th centuries, but what that does to Egypt itself, which is a country on the verge of modernization. And by learning more about its own past, it gains a greater confidence in its own future.
Yeah, and I guess to start it out for how we began to even understand what was going on is, if I'm pronouncing it right, Champollion, mm-hmm. And the first decipherment of hieroglyphics. And you discussed it.
You're absolutely right. And I mean, the really neat thing, I suppose, from an historian's point of view is that the two great discoveries in the history of Egyptology were, as you said, the decipherment of hieroglyphics by Champollion in 1822, and then the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb exactly a century later in 1922. So it's a very neat way of bookending, if you like, that golden age where for the first time people could read ancient Egyptian inscriptions and understand what they were saying, and then gradually began to sort of dig away literally and metaphorically at this great edifice of history and uncover all the riches.
So even though it's kind of like a, for want of a better word, a plebeian question, there's so many Americans and people around the world who are entranced with the concept of the curse of the mummy, the curse of the tomb. Tell us a little bit about that. It's interesting.
Well, it actually goes back to a little bit of a spat between journalists at the time of Tutankhamun's discovery. Lord Carnarvon, the sponsor of the excavation, signed an exclusive deal with the Times of London to report on the discovery. Now, this was the discovery not just of the year, of the century, of the greatest discovery that we'd ever made in archaeology. So you can imagine all these other correspondents from other news outlets were pretty miffed that they were being cut out of the deal. And so in order to sell newspapers, they essentially invented the idea of the curse, which they then ran with, and it became a story in its own right. And every time somebody involved with the discovery had an accident, there was another great story about the curse. So it really just dated back to, yeah, to that jealousy on the part of journalists that the Times of London had got a scoop.
And it's not much different today.
It's not much different today. If you haven't got a good story, make one up.
Right, and especially in America at this time. And so now we have the technology to actually make things look the way we want them to look, even if they don't.
We didn't. Yeah, absolutely.
So going back to the pyramids for a moment, just because, you know, once I got into the web and the getting lost in the internet as I was researching this and going down the rabbit hole, there was several interesting YouTube videos about how the pyramids were made. And the one theory about the ramps, and then there's this kind of offshoot theory about the water towers and how the stones would go up the water. But it's generally been debunked, but some people seem obsessed with it.
Well, you know, people will have their own pet theories about how the Egyptians were built or who built them. No amount of archaeological evidence or science can deflect some people from their favorite theories. So we kind of get used to that in Egyptology. There are people with very deeply held beliefs and evidence doesn't really come into it. It's more a question of faith and belief. The simple truth, of course, is that we have found remains of the ramps at various pyramid sites that were left in different stages of abandonment. So we know for a fact that ramps were used to build pyramids because, you know, we have actual ramps still existing. So in that sense, it's no great secret. Sure, they would have taken a lot of building, these ramps, but so did the pyramids. And if, you know, the Egyptians were short of technology, they certainly weren't short of manpower and they weren't short of time. And it's amazing with that combination of people and time, actually what you can achieve.
It is funny. That's what they asked Gaudi when he was taking so long with the Sagrado. They said, it's way too long. He goes, I don't think my client will mind.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, of course, in the case of the Egyptian pyramids, the client was the king, and he really did mind because he needed his pyramid to be finished before he died. So as soon as he came to the throne, he would have started on that project, and they would have worked at it, you know, as fast as they could, because in the ancient world, you didn't know how long you were going to last, how long you were going to live, and an unfinished pyramid was no use at all. So the heat was on from the get-go to really finish these monuments in record quick time. If you think about the Great Pyramid, I mean, we know from masons' marks on the backs of the blocks that it took not a lot more than 20 years to complete, which is an astonishing feat, particularly, as you say, when Sagrada Familia has been going for 100 years and still isn't finished.
It's funny, I think about it, and then I realize if you have an endless supply of dispensable manpower, there's a lot you can accomplish, just like as the terracotta soldiers or the Great Wall of China.
You know, absolutely.
No machinery, no drills, no awls, you know, nothing at all but men pushing and pulling.
Yep.
Well, so why do you think that it is that, I mean, we're all entranced with ancient Greece, we're entranced with Rome, and I guess the intersection to a certain extent with Egypt, but what is it that you think makes you, or anybody for that matter, feel that it's so important to learn as much as you can? Granted, I've always felt that gaining information is the prime directive in life, but what is it about learning this that you feel is so important to you and the rest of the world?
You know, for me, ancient history shines a light on contemporary affairs and indeed on our future as a human race. So the thing that strikes me about ancient Egypt is that of all the civilizations that have ever existed in world history, it was the longest living, the longest lasting. So ancient Rome lasted barely 1,000 years from start to finish. Ancient Greece, depending on how you define it, probably only lasted half that time. Ancient Egypt lasted 3,000 years, 3,000 years of a continuous civilization with a continuous form of government, a continuous culture. Sure, it adapted over time, but the basics that were there at the beginning were still there at the end. Never before and never since in human history has a civilization lasted that long. And I think it can teach us things about how humans interact with their environment. Let's face it, every mistake that we're making, the Egyptians will have made, because nothing is new, really, in terms of human dynamics. They had to solve problems that have never been posed before. How do you unite a nation together when it's spread out over a huge geographical area? How do you create a culture that people find so resonant and so powerful that they kind of get behind it and stay with it for 3,000 years? These were challenges that the Egyptians not only faced, but solved, and solved so spectacularly that civilization lasted 3 millennia. So, you know, I think we can learn an awful lot. Who was it who said, you know, those who don't learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them? for me, ancient Egypt is the best example we have of a society, of a civilization that solved these issues and ultimately was undone because it came to an end. We can learn a lot from that too. They had to grapple with climate change. They had to grapple with scarce resources. They had to grapple with the challenges of pressure from immigration. They had to deal with the challenges of food supply, all the sorts of things that we're having to deal with in the 21st century. And for me, it's just fascinating to see how they solved those so successfully.
Yeah, and as you say, it's the scale, perhaps more than any other civilization. We're talking about 2,500 years or longer?
3,000 years. 3,000 years from start to finish. And the hieroglyphs that were being written at the end of Egyptian civilization would have been recognizable to the people at the very beginning. I mean, that's astonishing. Western civilization is what, only really 1,000 years old at a push? Egypt lasted three times that length of time.
And look, in America now, we're entering perhaps a constitutional crisis, and you realize the Constitution is, what, 245 years old or thereabouts, and you think a democracy that lasted that long has a pretty good run. And you're talking about something 10 times that
much. Absolutely.
So I don't even understand how, in the latter parts, when you're talking about the fall, I don't even understand in the latter parts how they could, either by hieroglyphics or oral history, know what had happened earlier on. It would be us, like us, trying to imagine events 1,000 years before the birth of Christ.
Yeah, well, of course, Egypt has the great advantage of writing. And from the moment of the foundation of Egypt as a nation state in about 3,000 years before Christ, they start to record things. And they're really almost obsessive record keepers. And so even 3,000 years later, there were temple archives, there were records that dated way back to the origins of ancient Egypt. So the written word enables Egypt to gain a sense of its own history and to have a concept of what that 3,000 year span actually meant. Without writing, you know, things would have been lost through oral transmission, but writing is really the key to Egyptian civilization and its longevity.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the essentially black swan event of the Rosetta Stone, and for those who don't know, what it meant to us.
Yeah, it is absolutely one of the most remarkable stories in all of Egyptology. So Napoleon Bonaparte leads a great expedition to Egypt in 1798, partly for the greater glory of himself, partly for the greater glory of France, but also with a scientific mission to uncover the secrets of ancient Egypt. And while his soldiers are reinforcing a fortress at the site of Rosetta, modern El Rashid, in the north of Egypt, they come upon this broken stone with an inscription in different scripts. And because this is not only a military expedition, but a scientific expedition, there are people on hand who recognize the importance of this stone. And it's taken to Cairo, and it's studied by the scholars who recognize that it's an inscription, a royal proclamation, which is written in three different scripts, in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, in classical Greek, and then in a middle script called Demotic, which is a kind of everyday form of Egyptian in an abbreviated writing form. And so it's immediately recognized that this could be a key because they can read the ancient Greek, and so they know what the inscription says, and they know that the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs must say the same thing, but in the Egyptian language. But it provides the first real clue, the first real key to unlock the secrets of Egyptian writing. Now, why doesn't it end up in France? Because in 1801, Admiral Lord Nelson, the British naval officer, defeats Napoleon's naval forces at the Battle of the Nile. And as part of the war booty, the Rosetta Stone is shipped not to the Louvre in Paris, but to the British Museum in London. And there it becomes, and still remains, one of the great glories of that museum. And copies of the inscription are circulated to a number of scholars working away on the decipherment of hieroglyphics. And Champollion is one of them. And it's really the Rosetta Stone, as I say, that is the key to decipherment and begins that process of being able to read ancient Egyptian.
Well, from that basis, let's jump forward 100 years to the discovery of the tomb of King Tut. And I like the way you have these semi-epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter. And basically one says, you know, when you find something, kind of just get out of the way and let a bunch of Egyptians shovel away in the sand until you get there. So just as you explained the Rosetta Stone, why don't you go ahead and explain at least the mechanics of some of these discoveries? Because it's an arduous task.
It absolutely is. And in the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb, hundreds of thousands of tons of rubble was shifted from the floor of the Valley of the Kings. In fact, they built a special little railway to cart all of this stone chipping away from the dig site. And those chippings had been created over many centuries when later tombs were dug elsewhere in the valley, and all the spoil was just dumped into the valley floor. So you can imagine it accumulated to many, many feet in depth. So it took years to clear the valley of all these loose chippings with hundreds, if not thousands, of Egyptian workers. And actually, this is a really nice part of the story. Although it's Carter and Carnarvon who are credited with finding the tomb, we know from reading Carter's own journal that when he arrived on site on that morning when the tomb was discovered, actually the first step that led to the descending staircase that led to the tomb had already been uncovered by his workmen. So he arrived, saw that the workmen had kind of stopped, felt that there was a bit of a buzz at the site that morning, and said, "Hey, what's going on?" And this step had been uncovered. He claimed all the credit for it, but we know from his diary that actually it was the workmen who discovered it first. And there's a very nice little twist in the tale here. When you look at Carter's publication of the tomb, one of the most beautiful jewels from Tutankhamun's tomb is this necklace pendant with scarab beetles in lapis lazuli. And it's illustrated in the publication, not just on its own, but being modeled by a young Egyptian boy wearing a white linen shirt. And you think to yourself, why would Carter allow just an ordinary Egyptian boy to wear this priceless jewel? And the answer is that was the boy, that was the water boy who carried jars of water on his donkey from the Nile to the Valley of the Kings to supply the excavators with water. And because these water jars had appointed bases, in order to set them down on the ground, he had to, first of all, dig a little hole. And it was in digging that hole that morning, before Carter arrived, that this water boy uncovered the first step. So there was actually a nice gesture by Carter in allowing him then to be photographed modeling this necklace. But it's part of this hidden history of Egyptology. We think we know the great stories, but actually what I found in writing the book was that, you know, we know one version of the story, but actually there's so much more interest that lies behind them.
Yes, and the other thing is the faith that someone like you, for example, that believes something. It's like investing in a stock in the stock market and it keeps going down, and you know, you're just going to wait and eventually...
Right, because Carter had been working in the Valley of the Kings for 5 long years without discovering really anything at all. And he just had this passionate commitment and belief that there was still a tomb there to be discovered. I mean, he was not just basing this on a whim. He had some good evidence that pointed in that direction. But it was his self-belief that kept him going. And, you know, after 5 years of pretty expensive and fruitless searching, his patron, Lord Carnarvon, was getting pretty dispirited and said, "Look, I'm not sure I want to keep bankrolling this forever." And Carter drives to Carnarvon's country estate in England and persuades him, man to man, "Please just give me one more season, one more excavation opportunity to discover what I really feel in my heart of hearts is there." And Carnarvon relents and says, "Okay, one more year and then you're done." And it's that last season that the great discovery is made, and the rest is history.
Talk a little bit about the plunder, of course, but also the fact that during all this time, there's political upheaval around the world, there's wars. How is it possible that there was a continuity? Well, there really wasn't a continuity, but how is it possible that people could pick up where they left off after they were called, "Hey, you got to go fight in this war. This is no longer your valley, this belongs to you. How did that occur?
It's a really interesting question. And of course, the First World War is a big watershed moment in the history and politics of really the whole world, but also particularly in Egypt. Howard Carter was quite canny. He managed to stay in Egypt throughout the First World War because he knew his way around the country. He was very valuable to, you know, to the British government, the colonial government. We don't quite know exactly what he got up to during the war, but I imagine there was some quite clandestine activities going on. But he was also then able to carry on doing some really small-scale excavation in the Valley of the Kings, even during the First World War, just to make sure that he was, you know, spotting every opportunity and still in touch with what was going on. Lord Carnarvon was stuck in England throughout the duration of the war, but it was Carter who kept it going. But of course, what then happens after the First World War is the Egyptians, like a lot of people, wanted to throw off the colonial power and gain their independence. And there was a great move towards an independent Egypt, which was actually realized at the beginning of 1922 when Egypt was given independence. So by the end of that year, when Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered, the whole dynamic had changed, and the Egyptians wanted to keep their treasures for themselves, not have them exported to Western museums. And so there's quite a bit of political tension around the discovery. Although it's been made by, you know, a British expedition, the Egyptian authorities are very clear. This is our history, our heritage, and actually this is for modern Egypt to reclaim. And that discovery also provides a real spur to independence because, you know, the Egyptians have been downtrodden. They've been ruled by foreigners for hundreds of years at this point. And they're suddenly presented with this glorious treasure from their ancient past, proving that Egypt was once a mighty civilization that has, you know, that had no equal in the ancient world. And they look at this and they say, well, Egypt was this in the past. We can be this again. This gives us something to aspire to. Let's reclaim the glories of King Tut and make this our kind of guiding star for a modern independent Egypt. So at every stage of the process, politics and archaeology intertwine in a really interesting way.
It's funny. I apologize for looking down when you were answering, but I just happened across the words in this one review that says, the result of your book is an essential portrait of how the rediscovery of Egypt's ancient past paved the way for its modern rebirth. And when I read that, I was thinking, I wasn't understanding what you just explained. So I looked back at it.
Right, and so not only does it provide, as I say, this kind of ancient example of greatness that the modern Egyptians feel that they can seize and make as their aspiration for independence, but also by the time you get to 1922, Westerners have not just excavated in Egypt, they plundered Egypt for a century for the museums of the world, but also for private collections and just for sheer economic gain. And that begins to really grate on the Egyptians, who see their own history being literally carted off in great shipments to other countries. And so the very process of rediscovering ancient Egypt sparked this notion in the contemporary Egyptians that there has to be a better future. They don't want to be subservient to other powers for the rest of their days. They want something better. So archaeology is the kind of handmaid of political independence in that way.
It's interesting with regard to plunder. As a historian, it's almost like you're frustrated because you don't know what you don't know. You don't know exactly what was taken and what it would mean were it still to remain, correct?
Oh, you're so right. I mean, so much was lost in those early days of archaeology. Not just lost to poor excavation, but whole temples were ground up and used in lime kilns to power the Industrial Revolution in Egypt. So we have really no idea what we lost. We will have lost an awful lot. And it's, again, going back to your earlier question, what makes Egyptology so fascinating? It's like trying to do a jigsaw puzzle where you've only got half the pieces or maybe only even a third of the pieces, and you're still having to create that picture. And you'll never find those lost pieces, but you you use the pieces that you do have to try and flesh out the whole puzzle.
It is a different thing because for many years I practiced law, and one of the things I would always, one of my cliches that I always say to the jury is in the opening statement, was, this is like a jigsaw puzzle, and I'm going to show you the outside of the box so you can see what the picture is. Now all you have to do is put together the pieces. But you don't have the outside of the box.
No, we don't. That's even tougher as a puzzle.
Yeah, or it's like one of those where all the pieces are white.
Right. No, but it's what makes it endlessly fascinating, because each time you find a new piece of evidence, that gives you a new piece of the picture, which then may change how you create the rest of the picture around it. So it's a very dynamic discipline, and it's what makes it great fun.
And I think also what must make it interesting for you, I remember my hero, Richard Feynman, the physicist, he talked about, well, you're doing quantum physics and you think you've got to figure it out. You think of it as a chess game, and all of a sudden you see someone castling, and the king is moving these pieces and the rook moves this pieces, and you realize we didn't understand it at all. What is this little thing here? It makes no sense. And I assume that happens from time to time in your exploration.
It absolutely does. I mean, there are so many examples of a new discovery overturning previous theories. I charted all the way through the book, but really every one of those key discoveries in the 19th and early 20th century totally changed our picture of ancient Egypt. Before the 1880s, people thought ancient Egypt started with the pyramids, and they were the oldest thing that anybody knew. And then this great archaeologist called Flinders Petrie excavates a bunch of cemeteries that date back to way before the pyramids. And suddenly, our whole concept of how old ancient Egypt is just changes overnight. And sometimes it's the very small discoveries that make the difference. So finding the earliest piece of bronze, which then pushes back the start of metalworking in Egypt. Or I was involved in an excavation myself some years ago in Egypt, digging down in a big trench up in the Nile Delta. And we discovered a pot, a beautiful kind of V-shaped bowl like this, with painted decoration. And we knew from the layer that the pot had been found in that it must date back to about 3800 before Christ. So nearly 6,000 years old, this pot, and it was beautifully preserved. And it was also clear looking at the pot that it had been made on a wheel, because you could see the turning marks. Now, this was 2,000 years earlier than the previously earliest known wheel-made pottery in Egypt. So just this single discovery completely changed our view of Egyptian technology, and it was just amazing.
And so do you still go into the field? Do you still go to digs now?
I haven't been on a dig for many a long year, but I obviously still keep very close touch with excavators around Egypt and what's being discovered day after day.
Do you have, like you would say, as I said, physics, do you have symposia and meetings and conventions where you disagree on theories?
Oh, yes. I mean, the disagreements in Egyptology are very vociferous and longstanding. And as I explain in the book, the pride of individual archaeologists in their sites and in their interpretations led to some huge disagreements. I mean, as early as the 1820s, you had British and French archaeologists really disagreeing profoundly about things. And that has gone on over the last 200 years. And you know how it is, the smaller the subject, sometimes the more violent the disagreements. Yeah, we have plenty of that in Egyptology.
Right, it's like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Exactly, yeah.
I interviewed a woman, I think her name is Kara Cooney, who wrote When Women Ruled the...
Mm-hmm, yeah.
All, and she's very popular. She's been on talk shows and things like that. And we had a lovely chat, but in the back of my head, I'm wondering, how does she know some of these things? So there seemed to be somewhat of a gap, but she was extremely intelligent and obviously had done a great deal of research. But on some of her points, I was like thinking, I don't know how she would know that.
Well, there is a lot of evidence. It's been accumulated bit by bit over 200 years. So that picture has been sort of filled out. There are still gaps, as I said. And what the Egyptologist has to do, sometimes is to make an educated guess. But I think it's important for us to say when we're making an educated guess and when we're actually basing it on evidence. And yes, yeah, sure, we will never know, for example, how the ancient Egyptian language actually sounded. We simply don't know that because the script just preserves the consonants and not the vowels. But we can make an educated guess based upon, you know, other bits of evidence. But sometimes it is a bit of a leap of faith.
When you read hieroglyphics yourself, in your mind, what do you see? Do you see pictures? Do you see words? Do you see?
I see words. I mean, it's a bit like if you read something, you know, written in English, you know, once you get beyond first grade in school, you don't really divide words anymore into individual letters and you know, read out Egypt. You don't do that anymore. You just see Egypt and you know it's Egypt. And it's the same with reading hieroglyphics. I don't see the individual signs anymore. I see the words and the concepts that they're denoting. And you know, when I was a kid, I remember seeing a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And Bugs Bunny was, I guess he must have been in Egypt, or at least somewhere where it showed this column of an ancient Egyptian temple with hieroglyphic writing. And then sort of magically before Bugs Bunny's eyes, this writing turned into English writing and then turned back into hieroglyphics. And again, I wanted as a kid to be able to do that myself. And that's what happens now. When I see hieroglyphics, they just change into words before my eyes. It's great.
That's one of the analogies I've ever heard in my life. And I had forgotten if you started at the age of 5. Yes, it's almost like when you teach a young child Portuguese, who has a Portuguese nanny, for example. Yeah, it becomes second nature to you.
And you know, one of the most fun things I do as an Egyptologist is teach school kids how to read hieroglyphics. 5, 6, 7-year-old kids, and their teachers are saying, you've only got 1 hour, you're never going to do this. And we start from first principles, letter by letter, building it up into words. And you know, by the end of the hour, the whole class is writing their names in ancient Egyptian, they're reading each other's names. It's just great. It's great fun, and it can be done.
It must be. Looking at lots of different birds, children can identify with that so quickly. It's the interesting thing is about hieroglyphics is that it's a reflection of nature. No other,
yeah, that's right.
No other letters actually reflect in their actual shape the things that actually naturally occur in the world. At least I don't think there is a language like that. Other than
they're all taken. They're objects that are taken from the Egyptians' environment and then used to denote writing. But you're right. Children are very acutely aware of different kinds of bird, different kinds of animal, and they latch onto these hieroglyphics so naturally. It's a great joy to teach kids to read ancient Egyptian.
Well, so in conclusion, normally in an interview on Good Morning America or something like that, they would say something like, what are you working on next? Mm-hmm. But I would say to you, what are you working on for the rest of your life?
Well, there's an endless supply of topics when it comes to ancient Egypt. I mean, we've talked about it being a 3,000-year-old civilization that is longer lasting than ancient Rome or ancient Greece. So there's no shortage of things to write about. I have a new book in the pipeline, which I've just delivered to the publishers, so they'll be pleased about that. And I'm working on the two after that. You know, there are great characters from ancient Egypt. We've all heard about Tutankhamun. We've all heard about Cleopatra. But there are so many more interesting people that really deserve a full biography. So that's one idea I have. There are great cities in Egypt. We think of Egypt as monuments, like the pyramids or the Valley of the Kings. But, you know, there were spectacular cities there as well, which we're learning so much more about through archaeology. And again, there's a lot to be written about there. So I have no end of subjects that I'd like to write about if I can find the time.
Well, what's so nice is the history and this are both books that, and some of your other writings aren't, I would think, as accessible. These two books are very accessible to the public, to the general. And the reason I say that is because I own an independent bookstore, and the book will be on the front table now that we're open again. And it's interesting because I looked at both the UK cover and the American cover. And as many times as people say to you, don't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into my bookstore, unless they know what they're looking for, judges every single book by its cover. And both of those covers are beautiful. I think I like the UK one better, actually. But the American one looks almost like a scene from like the movie Exodus or something like that, which I also...
Right. Yeah, no, it does capture very nicely the kind of the excitement, the intrepid nature of early archaeology, I think, which is, you know, what the book's all about, how these extraordinary men and women uncovered a world beneath the sands and transformed our understanding of a whole civilization. So, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and now that I think about it, I realize the reason I'm interviewing you is because I saw the cover and I asked my producer, can you get this? Because the cover entranced me because it seemed like this great adventure I was about to embark.
Fantastic.
Well, thanks.
I hope you and your readers enjoy reading the book. It's certainly been great fun to write it.
And we have an excellent nonfiction book club that I think would, except they won't spring for the hardcover. They'll wait till it comes out in paperback. Substantial discount. Well, thanks again. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
It's been such a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on your show.